Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion rate optimization and working in the web. And on this week's show, we're going to discuss defining our role as design leaders, how UX agencies and consultants like myself and Marcus are doomed, and we're going to show you how you should go about using AI code. My name's Paul BOAG and joining me always is Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Paul.
So this is going to be a competition of who's the most grumpy, right?
Well, I'm going to try and go on. You tell me.
I was just going to say because you're arranging a wedding, obviously you're at your wit's end. You do your pitch for grumpiness, and then I'll do mine. How about
that? I have two aspects to my grumpiness. Oh. So I'll do aspect one.
Right.
Then you can have your turn. Then we'll come back to aspect two for me.
How about that? Go on then.
Aspect one is I've been herding cats now for about 3 weeks trying to organise this wedding. I think I talked about it on the last show, didn't I?
Yeah,
maybe,
you did.
I don't know. Anyway, still don't have a caterer. I found a really brilliant caterer. Fantastic, perfect. It even had a connection to sort of, you know, people we knew. Can't do that date. And also last night found another one that looked like they're going to be reasonably priced. This would be great. And I thought that they'd come back. Basically, Michelle used this service where you can kind of put in, we're doing this thing on this day. Do you want a bid? And I thought they'd come back via that. So they were available. Woo. And then it's no. Susan mentioned them. And it's like, shit. So I know what's going to happen. I haven't had the chance today.
McDonald's?
Interestingly, the guy that owns the place, because it's in the middle of a forest, he said, for an evening thing, what a lot of people have done is just get Domino's to deliver a load of pizzas. And I'm like, that's
actually
genius.
Not a bad idea. That's actually quite good. I quite like that.
Boxes of hot pizzas
at
9 o'clock in the evening. Yeah. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good one.
I like that. Yeah, so, no, that's good. So that's your number one. Number two is I won't be allowed to eat the pizzas if you do that. I know this is serious.
Was it dairy or gluten?
Dairy and what causes things to rise? I always forget the name. Yeast.
Oh, right.
So at the moment, I'm banned from both, only for about 6 months. But
only 6 months.
I know.
Even 6 days would be bad enough. Seriously.
Kath said to me earlier, should we go to Pizza Express tomorrow? And I said, what for? What's the point? She sits there eating dough balls in front of me. Yeah, so that sucks.
So no bread. Weight will fall off you.
Well, sourdough, because we're off to America soon, so they have sourdough everywhere, and I can have that because that doesn't use yeast.
Well, it sort of does, but not added yeast.
No.
Okay. I might eat sourdough mostly anyway. You can get sourdough pizzas, like restaurants you that can. Do sourdough
yeah, yeah,
pizzas.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. So go on then, what's your second?
Come on. I've got to get more into this. No dairy either.
No ice cream. I love ice cream with a passion. What? And apparently that's half my problem. I've been eating too much ice cream and I've screwed my stomach. Anyway. Yes.
You could have the sort of poor man's ice cream, the yogurt stuff, couldn't you?
Yes, I could have
that. Is that still dairy-y, though? I don't know.
I'd have to look into that as to whether I'm allowed that.
What would do me would be the cheese, the no cheese.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I can give up ice cream, I could give up milk or, you know, that, but cheese.
This is a really shit podcast so far. You do realise that. But it's your turn to moan
moaning.
Now. Yeah. It's your turn now. Well, go on, second moan.
This is now going to... No, I'm going to be all bright and chirpy now because I'm going to do something I hardly ever do.
What's that?
Which is talk about...
compliment me.
And...
Oh, right.
I often compliment you. Obviously, never to your face, Paul.
Obviously not. Oh, it's not the British way. Oh, we're going to talk about Headscape. What's been happening at Headscape?
Basically, I don't... sales opportunities have gone...
Nothing. I know. Yes,
complete
you were saying
tumbleweed.
About that. Yeah.
Complete tumbleweed. This is very rare.
Yeah.
That's one of the dogs yelping in the background.
That's because it's worried it won't get fed because there's no money coming into Headscape.
And bearing in mind what we're going to talk about later, then maybe it's just a precursor to what's going to happen.
Doom. Yeah.
Anyway, but sales opportunities, and we won a couple of them, were really quite good before Christmas, but now it's just like zero. Right. Nada. Nothing at all. So it's advertising time.
Headscape.
Hi. I got shiny teeth in and everything.
Yeah.
Why would you hire Headscape? Well, basically, we are.
Hang on. I think I should do this.
You do it every week, Paul.
No. For you, right? Because I am now independent. I have no shares in Headscape whatsoever. I have no ownership over Headscape. Have I got shares? I haven't, have I?
Oh,
I
suppose you are owed a debt.
I'm owed a debt. Yes, that's a good point. Okay, carry on then, because I thought I was going to give an unbiased, glowing thing, but no, I'm owed money, so.
Decades of experience, no bullshit.
Yeah.
That'll do.
I think that's very good.
That's how we work, you know.
Do you know what? That's one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of a web design agency. I think you should put that on your website. Just that as the heading.
That's it. I'm redoing the copy right now.
Do that.
As we speak.
I think that will make people smile and sums up Headscape. It is exactly what you're like. Do it.
We're also very good, but I guess
the decades
of experience of delivering mediocrity.
Now that's an even better strapline. Go with that one.
No, because it's not true. We're very good.
I know. Yeah. I still maintain. Obviously, I can't comment on your new developers because I don't know them as well. But Ed and Lee, I still maintain are some of the best designers I have ever worked with. They are outstanding, both of them.
Can I just stop you there? I know that Lee listens to this. So.
Oh, shit. Damn.
Lee is also a developer these days. Hard to believe, but he is. Yeah, yeah. Actual real developer
stuff.
Well,
he was always...
Because of AI.
Yeah, and he was always that way inclined. If you go back to the early days, he was that way inclined. And I actually use Lee quite a lot as... this is going to be the longest podcast in the world because we haven't even got past the introduction yet. Oh. I always use Lee as a case study. Not case study, but an example, right? Because you come across a lot of people that feel like to progress their career, I've got to become a design leader or a senior manager or something like that, and they end up not doing what they love. And one of the things that I respect, and what they're good at, one of the things that I respect about Lee is he's gone, I'm a designer, you know, I mean, I know he does consultancy stuff and that kind of thing as well. You know, he is a UX designer in the broadest sense of the word, but he's always been very focused about what he loves and what he does, you know, and I think that's the way it should be, you know?
Yeah. Born tinkerer as well, which I think.
Oh, yeah.
You would do it anyway, even if you didn't have to do it for work. But interestingly, and well, I'll get into this a bit more detail when we get on to the why we're all doomed later. Yeah, I think it's more for some than others, and probably Lee and Ed less so. I think people will always want stylists, if you like, for want of a better term.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, I mean, so if you're looking for user research, UX or UI design, front-end coding or WordPress or Drupal back-end work, then look no further than headscape.co.uk.
Why don't we skip? Why don't we skip directly to the why Headscape have got no work and we're all doomed? Actually, I don't think it's that. Because I thought that was quite an interesting one. So this was an article written by Jacob Nielsen, bless his cotton socks.
I know, I didn't think it's a little bit tabloid.
Yes, it didn't feel
not his
like...
style.
No, not at all, no. So he's written this article called Future is Lean, Mean and Scary for UX Agencies. It's basically a critique of, you know, the where things are currently at in the sector and where things are going to go. And it's a mixture of talking about a little bit about AI, but a lot about the fact that a lot more organizations are building up internal teams, and that these internal UX teams means that they don't have such a need for external consultants and agencies and things like that. And obviously because it's Jacob Nielsen, it has a lot of reach. And I think there is, it's not that it's not true in my opinion. I think there is a move that way, but I think it's very biased by his personal experience. And
yes,
the kind of organisations that he's likely to work with, right?
Huge organisations who will have massive internal teams. He's also been immersed in AI for the last year.
Yes. Yeah.
That's my point on this one. Are all those millions of businesses and organisations in the world that have websites thinking like that? Nah. When they come around to redoing their website, they'll just be in the same headspace-ish that they were when they did it last time, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think agencies will be working a lot more. It depends what kind of timescales you're looking at as well. Because, yes, there is this move right at the top to bring more stuff in-house. Understand that. That's been around for a while, to be honest.
And 15 years, I reckon, we started talking about that. So if it is coming to a head now, and he's right, then kind of fair enough. I can't argue with that. There are many people that work within organisations who are developers, but they don't have anyone else. So, you know, developers are part of that UX thing as well. And the other way around, there'll be people that do research to help make whatever it is they do better, but they won't have any developers. So from what I've seen, and again, I'm on a very narrow view, I guess, it's piecemeal. Some people have no team at all. Others have quite a few people, but we're not, in my view, at that point now where bigger organisations, not the biggest, but those sort of middle-sized organisations who've got decent budgets, who want quality, have complete teams that do what we can do.
No. And even if they do, even if they have those, because I work with a lot of organisations that have supposed UX teams, they're all overstretched and under-resourced, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so there's always going to be a place of bringing in outside experts for those bigger periodic projects, you know, where you need to make a bigger change or maybe even redesign or whatever else. Also, it just doesn't make sense for every organization to have a UX team, even if they're big enough to be able to support it. That's not always the most sensible way of doing things. So, it threw me a little bit because there's no doubt at the moment that there is a downturn in the industry. You know, you're obviously suffering from this. I think a lot of other people are. And so my immediate reaction is, well, is this the reason why? But I don't think it is really. I think it's more global economic kind of situations. I think if anything, it's that the shine has gone off of UX a little bit because everybody's now gone on to the shiny AI thing. And so, in my opinion, if that's going to have any kind of effect, it would be that in-house teams are reduced in size because suddenly UX isn't the high priority that maybe it was 5, 6 years ago.
I also think that, and you know, we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot a bit here, all of us. Then, 15 years ago, not even probably 10 years ago, there was still a lot of shit out there that you could. That desperately needed redoing, making secure, performant, accessible, all of those kind of things. And most stuff these days is pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a bit of too much of a kind of generalisation, but
the standard is certainly a lot better than it was 10 years ago.
You don't come across horror show websites very often.
No.
You'll find little niggly things wrong with the experience and all that kind of thing. But generally speaking, things are built much better than they were once. And I also think that potentially means that if you are in with somebody, they're much more likely to just keep fiddling, updating the thing they've got.
And so they should.
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to build something brand new.
I mean, how long have I been talking about redesigns are a bad idea? For as long as I can remember, I think.
Yeah. And we've just done a kind of rework of a law firm site. Based on a new branding they had, so it does happen, and I guess to a degree, that might be a real factor here for agencies that brand new opportunities coming along are probably a lot thinner on the ground, not only because they're going in house, but because they're staying with their incumbent,
yeah,
because it doesn't make sense not to,
yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so we're all doomed anyway.
It's a bit of a weird one. But I mean, you know, and then he rolled in some weird AI stuff. And absolutely, I think AI will have a huge difference, make a huge difference. I think it will empower both agencies and in-house teams to do a lot more with a lot less. So there's valid points with that. But I don't think it's going to replace anybody. The more I see of it.
Yeah, I do. I like the idea that we can do the same for a lower figure. That's really appealing. I mean,
well, you see, I don't think it's going to be that way round, right? And I'll tell you why. It's less time.
I guess.
Yeah. Okay. But this is what's happened. If you look back through the kind of history of web design, this isn't the first time we've had a real time-saving tool come along, right? Yeah. I remember when everybody used to write JavaScript by hand, right? JavaScript. And then you had things like jQuery and blah, 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 all those kinds of stuff. So all of which were a time saver. Did that lead to cheaper projects or faster projects? No. It just led to more sophisticated solutions that did more and were more powerful. And I think that will be exactly the same with AI. It's not that suddenly we've halved the price of a web design project. No, we'll just be doing double the amount of stuff in it. And I already know that, you know, because I do a lot of kind of business cases and that kind of thing, justifying UX and blah, blah, blah. And like, I was doing one at the moment where I had to do a competitive review. And they threw a whole load of competitors at me, way more than I budgeted for in the project. And I thought, oh, okay, I can do that now because I can use Wevo Plus to go through and, you know, give me an initial pass of them. And then I can, you know, pick through it and pick bits out. And so I ended up just reviewing double the number of sites than I would have traditionally because I could, you know. Mm. So, yeah.
Okay. I mean, we'll see on that one. I think that maybe there might be, because it's such a revolution, as Jacob Nielsen says, rather than, it's more of a revolution than a new tool. I think it's bigger than that.
Yes,
there
I
might
would agree.
Be a case to make, there may be a case to make that we can be more efficient. Therefore,
but that's,
do more in the
time. I know what you're
saying. I'm not saying we can't, or can't, but there may be.
I agree with that, but I remember exactly the same conversation when PCs came along, and you got to say that was a revolution.
Yeah,
and
true.
And there was talk at the time. Oh, you know, we'll all go down to 3-day weeks because we'll be no.
Oh, well, just, why couldn't we have done that, Paul?
I know, right? That was the thought at the time. Not that we would do more, but that this would enable us to be more efficient and so we'd do less. Bullshit to that. That never happened. So that's why I don't think any of us are going to ever be out of jobs. It, you know, I think we might have to change jobs and I think things will restructure. And, but it's not like, yeah, they'll just squeeze more out of us. That's all that'll happen.
Yeah, well, we've got... Headscape's got to do some sort of strategic thinking over the next month or two and... How, well, basically, I think you've been saying this for about the last three or four months. We need to get serious about how we're going to pull AI into our processes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, give me a shout if you want to talk about that.
Do you know anything about AI?
Well, you know what I'm like. I've got an obsessive compulsive personality. Ooh, new shiny thing. Let me go play with that for hours upon end rather than do. Yeah. See, that's why I don't think AI is going to provide productivity gains because it just is a huge distraction to me, which I go and play Ooh. With for hours. Yeah. Talk about apps. Quick app for this week. Because I'd like to give you an app. Everybody likes a new app or, again, a new shiny thing. So this week's one is called UXpressia. And it basically is a visualization tool. And so what it does is it helps you create and visualize things like customer journey maps, personas, impact maps, that kind of stuff. It's just a drag and drop kind of design tool. And there's loads of templates you can use and stuff like that. Now, you might be thinking, what use is that to me? I'm a designer. And the answer is it's zero use to you. In fact, what it produces is slightly ugly, in my humble opinion. But it is brilliant for involving other people in the creation process. And maybe getting marketers or your product team to kind of, that maybe are doing a bit of user research and they want to create visualizations. Or it's a great tool for basically getting non-UXers to conduct their own little bit of user research and then to visualize that. And it kind of brings them into the fold a little bit. So it's perfect for empowering stakeholders and team members when they've got limited design experience, and it makes them feel like they're contributing meaningful, you know, stuff to the UX strategy and that kind of thing, which brings me actually on to the subject which I wanted to talk about today. And this really follows on partly from that app, which is about empowering other people to do some user research type stuff, partly with our conversation about in-house teams and where in-house teams are going. And that is talking about the role of UX design leaders.
Is that a double segue, Paul?
It's a double.
I think it was.
It was. I'm just tying.
You're a pro.
I'm tying the loose strands of our pointless waffle together. And also, this very much relates to Marcus's wedding as well. Give me a minute.
What?
I'll find a way of weaving that in. Yeah. Right. So really this bit is a bit more for if you work in-house. As I said earlier, right, a lot of in-house UX teams are under-resourced and overworked. And a big part of that, I think, is because they're not the ones that are necessarily defining their roles. And so what I want to kind of leave you as my thought for the day is to really look and ask yourself, is there an opportunity here for me to take control of my own role and what it is that I am doing within my organization? I've just been working with a lot of groups at the moment, a lot of UXers across various organizations, all of which seem to be stuck in a cycle of implementing other people's ideas and not really having that big an impact on the user experience as a whole, because they're just churning through user interfaces for whoever, some senior management. Go for it, Marcus. Why are you raising your hand?
Mr. Boeg, can I go to the toilet? Another thread that we could pull into that would be if you are overworked.
You're going to do an ad for Headscape. You're sounding
desperate.
You could
hire Headscape to help you out. You know?
That was subtle. I don't think anybody will even notice that pitch. So anyway, I haven't even got to the first bullet point yet. So I think the idea of other people defining your role is dangerous because they don't really understand the UX process. They don't really know what a great UX leader does. And so, you know, if you don't take control of your role, what other people do is they kind of fill the void and they will give you busy work. They will give you stuff that they think they want doing or try and offload stuff that they don't want to do onto you. And so I'm really encouraging all of you, if you work as a UXer within an organization, sit down, forget the reality of what is today, and instead think about what would my role be if I could define it myself, right? And I want to encourage you to look at three different elements that I'm going to just briefly explore here. The first is what's your goal? Right? What is it that you should be accomplishing? Not the projects, but what can you help with within the organization? Right? Secondly, what resources do you have available? And we'll come on to that in a minute. And third is what can you influence? Right? So let's look at each of those in turn. Defining your goals, right? In an ideal world, senior management, should define organizational objectives, right? So, and often you get these kinds of, you know, what they call kind of company strategies that they produce once a year and everybody shoves in a drawer and ignores. But that actually shows what it is that management care about. And so you might want to dig that out, look through that, And they'll list vague things like, we want to be the number one in pharmaceutical care in the UK, or we want to, you know, increase efficiency by 25% by 2027, and things like that. So you take all of those things and you say, which of those as a UX professional can I contribute to, right? Which of those do I think that I could help with? So, you know, it might be that they're seeking a younger demographic, or they want to be carbon neutral, or whatever it is. And then you can align your UX goals with those things and start saying, okay, this is what I'm going to prioritize my work around. I'm going to prioritize the work I do, not on who shouts the loudest or not on the first come, first serve basis, but I'm going to start saying, I'm going to work on this because this is the company goal that has been set. And obviously you're thinking, I know what you're doing. You're sitting there thinking, well, I don't have the power to do that. Absolutely. I understand that, you know, so once you've kind of got those company goals and you've laid them out and you've written down how you can contribute to each of those goals, take that to your manager and say, look, I'm trying to be a bit more focused in the way that I'm working and the way that I'm operating. And so this is my thinking about how I can do that. Would you agree that it's good for me to organize myself around, you know, company goals and company structures? They kind of have to say yes, really. And so that then gives you leverage further down the line when people start asking you, you know, to do things that are a waste of time, for you to say, well, I have agreed with my manager that my focus is going to be in these areas. So that's tip number one. Okay. Tip number two is to review the resources that are available to you. Now, we have a habit, in my experience, of our initial reaction is to fixate on what we don't have rather than what we have, okay? So, and what that leads us is, you know, for us constantly going back to management and going, we don't have enough people, or, you know, oh, I'm too busy, and, you know, little violins and all of this kind of stuff. And you may be right about that, but the truth is, the manager doesn't have an endless pot of money that he can hire new people with. And anyway, managers have half their job is just saying no to people. So instead, what I would encourage you to do is look at your resources that you've got, whether it be, you know, do you have any discretionary budget? What software is at your disposal? Can you access in-house staff? Do you have an incredible agency like Headscape on tap at the drop of a hat? I don't know why you're raising your hand there.
On a retainer.
On a retainer at a very reasonable rate. Is there... Okay, he's shaking his head at that.
less than Paul Bowie.
That doesn't take a lot, to be honest. Is there training and coaching that you can leverage from an excellent trainer like Paul Boag? consider how much autonomy you have. All of these kinds of things. Think about your resources and map them out, right? And then you will go, okay, well, that is the constraint within which I need to work. So now you need to start planning your role within that context. So, for example, one of the things that I typically find is that most teams are under-resourced to touch all of the UX projects that are out there, okay? And so they end up just kind of taking a slither of things that they can actually work on. And obviously, that's not very productive. It doesn't actually make a big difference to the user experience. So what I'm increasingly doing is saying, okay, well, let's stop you doing implementation work. I know this sounds radical, but let's stop you spending all of your time in Figma and blah, 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 and all of that kind of stuff. And instead start teaching developers and project managers and business analysts to do a bit of user research, do a little bit of testing, do a little bit of wireframing. And so that you can then become like an internal consultant or coach across the organization and make a much bigger difference across more of it. That's exactly what I'm doing at the moment with Oxford University, right? And a part of that, setting aside all of the jokes about hiring Headscape, is when you get pushed back over that, you can do things like set up a preferred supplier list where you vetted certain agencies that are on that you know are going to be good and you know are going to work in the way you want them to work. And if other people don't want to do that stuff themselves internally, despite you providing all of this help and support to them, then they can go and hire an agency. But that agency would be beholden to you because they want to stay on the preferred supplier list. I was trying to explain this to a group of in-house people. And they were going, we don't want people going off and hiring agencies willy-nilly and doing all this kind of weird stuff. And I was saying, I absolutely know what you mean. But if you have a preferred supplier list and if you own the preferred supplier list, and Marcus, I'm sure, will back me up on this, we know that we want to keep you sweet, right? Rather than all the individual stakeholders we're working with across the organization, because you decide whether or not we're on that list. So there is, we become your representatives effectively out in the rest of the organization, because we're afraid that you might throw us off the list. So there is a, you know, it's a way of working anyway.
Being on a roster as an agency is, it's gold, basically.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important things you can do or get on. It's certainly been fantastic for us.
Absolutely. So it can be a very powerful tool for you to start broadening your influence, and you kind of move from being, stuck in Figma all day designing somebody else's ideas to starting to designing design systems, to creating education material, training material, empowering colleagues across the organization, raising the profile of UX, etc. And that brings me on to the final point, which is to think about what you can influence. There's probably a lot more in the organization you can influence that will have a bigger impact on the user experience than you just working on individual projects. Things like people across the organization. How can you, start exciting people about UX? You know, how can you bring together those different people across the organization that already get UX and get them reinforcing one another and encouraging one another? How can you educate people? How can you encourage people to care about the user experience? That's what your job should be as much about. And processes as well. You know, can you create policies or procedures that help embed user-centric thinking across the organization? And how can you even maybe influence the culture a little bit of the organization by introducing certain metrics that maybe shift people's perspective? Because we are terrors as human beings that if you give us a metric, we will obsess about it. And a story I'm sure I've told before at some point on the podcast, but I remember working with a university once where they sent out every month basically a Google Analytics report to all the department heads, all the different faculties, which had loads of the vanity metrics, you know, and number of user sessions, bounce rates, all this kind of stuff. And it took them quite a long time to do this every month, and it was like a right pain in the butt doing it. And it was nobody ever, they were just looking at pointless metrics. So I said, well, why don't we replace it with some more user-centric methods like time on page or, excessive scrolling or things that give you a bit more of an indication of how users feel about the page. And I said, well, why don't we, instead of having it as a report that's sent out to everybody, why don't we just create a league table where we rank all of the faculties against one another, against these new criteria? And of course, it brought out the competitive nature amongst the faculties. The business department were pissed off that they weren't higher than engineering, were far more important than engineering, you know. And so we invested a load of time in improving the user experience of the business department, helping them improve their score. And then the engineering lot got upset because why are you helping the business people so much? Look, they've passed us now. And so we then spent a load of time with the engineering people. So metrics could be a really powerful tool. Also, policies and procedures. You think, like, we have an HR department, right? In companies, we have a legal department. Does that mean that I can say whatever I want to whoever I want in the organisation, because it's HR's problem to worry about, you know, political correctness and that kind of stuff. Hell no, right? Can I go and spend money on whatever I want? Because the finance people are the people that worry about money. No, of course not, right? And so what do those departments do? They set up policies about what you can and cannot do. I would argue the same is true with UX. Right? Everybody is responsible across the organization for the user experience. We all contribute to it. And we as teams, our responsibility is to create the policies and procedures that stop people doing bad shit. So I would say that's a part of our role. So we're redefining our role away from being basically pixel pushers for, you know, product owners or whatever, more towards being educators, standard setters, consultants, and empowering the rest of the organization and effectively democratizing UX. And I think that is the way more and more internal UX teams are going to have to go, as long as that, as long as they are under-resourced, you know, for the job that they're doing. And just by way of reference, you might think, well, what do I mean by under-resourced? Okay. Marcus, in Headscape, how many developers do you have?
Well, what?
Full-time developers.
Full-time, three.
And how many full-time designers do you have?
Two.
Right. Look at that ratio. All right. That is not that ratio that Marcus has just described is about average for most agencies. Okay. Now look at your organization. How many developers do you have compared to how many UX people? I normally say there should be a 2-to-1 ratio. So two developers for every one UX person. So Marcus is, about that. It's a bit off, but, you know, it will change. And they are more of a UX-focused organization anyway.
People wear different hats as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bit difficult
to
say.
We've probably got five developers, but they do other things as
well. So, but my point is that's not what you'll see in most organizations, nowhere near that ratio. So, so expecting another reason to hire an external agency, but you're expecting therefore, you to kind of do an impossible amount of work for the number of developers you've got going. So you can't do that. You've got to change the way in which you operate. And that's where I am in my thinking. I'll be really interested to hear what other people think about that. Drop me an email because it's a thought process that's evolving in my head, and it's how we're tackling it. I've tackled it now in a few organizations because you can never get headcount for the real numbers you need.
Yeah, I mean, most web teams are often two or three people.
Yeah,
and I use the team web team because that will include the developers.
Yeah,
but maybe four or five. But the organisations that are big enough to have a team of multiple people looking after, you know, web, intranet, apps, all of the kind of things they do, are going to have enough work to keep those people looking after that stuff almost permanently. Mm. We need more people. I mean, I know I've been joking all the way through about hiring us, but that's part of the reason why we are getting hired, and why I think maybe Jacob Nielsen isn't right yet, is there's not enough people internally doing this stuff.
No, and, there's not.
Yeah, so we're still needed.
So their choices, really, your choices are you go to somebody like Headscape, you get an agency in and you do it that way. But obviously there's a cost associated with that, you know, or you build up your in-house team and add a load more people, and there's a cost associated with that, or you change your UX team into more of a kind of consultative and standards based department and essentially democratize UX. So everybody is doing a bit of it. And, you know, all three ways have got their pros and cons, you know? I mean, Yeah, there are definitely downsides to democratizing it, but that's a whole nother session than we've got longer than we've got today.
Exactly.
Last thing that I want to talk about today is an interesting conversation, and this goes back to what you were talking about earlier about getting Headscape using AI more. In the Agency Academy, we've been talking about, we had a really weird one where somebody came to, sorry, first of all, the Agency Academy, in case people don't know. So we've got our Agency Academy is a mixture of agency owners and freelancers, right? So it's a little subscription thingy that I run for like £25. I can't remember how much it is. £25 a month, and then we do weekly calls, and we've got Slack channel, and we all hang out together. And so we have basically is a big moaning session about all of our different problems that we have. And one of the people in the group was moaning recently about how a client came to them, and they'd been trying to build something with AI and get AI doing the coding for them. And they got like 90% of the way there, and then they got stuck, and they wanted to come to the developer and the developer to you know, finish it, you know, to do it, because they didn't manage to do it in AI. But they kind of figured that, oh, well, because we did it in AI and it, you know, it's obviously not going to be a big job. And I think this is going to become an increasing problem, right? Where people see AI as this magic answer that can slice through the costs of doing these things, just like Marcus was talking about earlier on. And as well, they're going to think that they can do a lot of this stuff themselves. And I don't know whether you remember this, because you were working in the paper industry, so you might remember this. Do you remember when desktop publishing first came along? Were you in the paper industry at that point?
Yes, I was.
It went through this really weird stage where it was like, you know, before desktop publishing, if you wanted a flyer or a poster or anything like that, you would go to a printer who would do it all for you, do the layout and all the rest of it. And desktop publishing came along and everybody went, oh, we can do it ourselves now. And it went through this period of time of just shockingly terrible everything, right? Yes. And so all the graphic designers in the world were sitting there going, no, you can't do this. And there was Comic Sans and Papyrus everywhere.
Yeah, but and then, pink and yellow.
Yeah, and oh, and then, but gradually people realised, no, we need somebody who actually knows what they're doing to do this job. And sure, the bottom end fell out. You know, you wouldn't get somebody, a printer, to do your birthday, you know, invites for, you know, your little birthday party. But yeah, the bit, you know, the proper professional stuff had to be done by a professional. And I think that is exactly what we're going to see with code as well. Mm-hmm. But it does leave us in this awkward tie. I think we'll see it with design as well, but I think that's a bit further away. That does leave many coders and developers in this awkward time where at the moment clients think they know better. Mm. And so we had a little conversation that I wanted to repeat back to people on the podcast about how do you deal with this, right? Obviously, we as developers are going to be using coding tools, AI coding tools, right? Because AI does save you a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it is absolutely worthwhile. And I think most developers are realizing we should be integrating that into our workflow. But that's a long way from suddenly saying, okay, everything's going to be, you know, really easy to do. And so the way that I'm describing it to my clients at the moment is AI, using AI is great if you know whether or not what it's producing is good, and if you know the right questions to ask.
Yeah, they're the two main points. I used the words, will we know if it's accessible, performant, and secure? And
yes,
if I build something using AI, I'm not a developer. I haven't got a clue. No. Oh, no. It works. Fantastic. It's a bit like, you can do a little bit of a sort of musical analogy or an artistic analogy of any sort. You can't do Jackson Pollock without being able to do,
yes, you know,
photorealistic art in the first place.
Yeah.
That's...
you've got to, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to kind of run with something, you've got to have the basic knowledge in the first place.
Yeah.
But you're right, for really small stuff,
yeah,
you know, for like small time websites and things like that, then I guess people won't care about the things I've just described. They'll just do it.
Yeah. And a great example of that is, you know, I wanted to write a little app that allowed me to automatically send out my kind of report time reports to my mentors. And as long as it works, I'm happy. You know, I don't need to worry about security. I don't need to worry about anything else. And that's fine. Mm. But and you might be thinking, you know, so I can imagine some clients going, well, as long as I know it has to be secure and performant, why can't I can just ask AI, what things do I need you to check on this? And it's it will come back and tell me it's got to be secure and it's got to be, perform well and accessible and all the rest of it. And then I just say to it, oh, well, make this accessible. And that's great in principle. But as we all know, AI says things very, very confidently and is not always correct. Mm. And so it will say, I've gone and made this accessible or I've gone and made this secure, but it doesn't mean it's really done it. Yeah. And you need a developer to check all of that. Now, then you might go, oh, well, that's fine. I can produce it to X standard, you know, get as far as I can, then just send it to a developer and they can check it over for me. Right?
Yes, we all know how much developers like working with someone else's code.
There you go. And it's not, and there is a reason behind them not wanting to do that. Yeah. And the reason being is it's hard. It's like trying to read something in a foreign language that you don't really understand. You have to follow the chain of thought. And actually, it will end up taking them as long than if they just built it all from you from scratch.
Exactly.
So, we need to get really good at articulating that little narrative we've just run through there, because there is going to be a period of time when everybody's going to see AI as this magic thing that's just going to solve all of our problems, and it's not.
Well, it kind of can if you know what you're doing.
Yes, yeah.
Basically. Yeah. That's why I think there are efficiencies for Headscape and developers who know what they're doing. There must be efficiencies there.
There are. Yeah.
It doesn't suddenly mean it's like, you know, I'm no graphic designer. I can't. You know, you're not going to hire me to do posters for your new film, even though I might have the tools to do it.
Yes.
You still need the skills. In the first place.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So I think that kind of wraps up this week's show. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I do. This is from Lyle Barris in the Boag World.
Oh, good.
Slack channel.
Yeah.
I asked the librarian if they had any books on paranoia. She whispered, "They're right behind you."
Yeah. That's acceptable.
About the level. Well done.
Yeah, I feel that you've hit about the right level there. That's good.
Okay.
I preferred, what was the terrible pun you told a couple of episodes ago? I can't remember now.
I literally fall out of my head as soon as I've told you.
Well, of course, yeah. The ones that I groan the most at are the ones I like the most. So I do like a good terrible pun.
I'll find you a dreadful pun for next.
Okay, that's good. All right. Okay, I hope there was stuff in there that you found useful, and we apologise for the amount of moaning that we did in this episode.
And selling.
Tune in next week for one very long advert and a lot of moaning. Till then, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Bye.